Welcome to this podcast from Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club of California, by and for people in their 20s and 30s with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. This podcast is made possible through support from the members of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club. To learn more about events or membership, visit us online at commonwealthclub.org/inforum or join us on Facebook, MySpace, and LinkedIn.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club by and for people in their 20s and 30s with a mission to inspire debate on civic issues. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org/inforum. I am Carmen Dixon, creator of All About Race, and I am a columnist on AOL's Black Voices. Tonight, for our discussion, we've brought together Cheo Tayumba and Richard Thompson Ford to uncover the politics of Black in America today. This groundbreaking year in politics will likely not bring an end to racism in America, but will it help close the racial divide at all? African Americans have politicized art, music, culture, and comedy to make statements about the inequality between races in America. Nationally, African Americans are overrepresented in prisons and in the poorest communities, while drastically underrepresented in America's institution of higher education and politics. What are the politics of being Black in America today? To answer these questions and others, we have Cheo Tayumba. Cheo Tayumba is an award-winning journalist, activist, and author of The Ghetto Solution. At San Francisco's Museum of the African Diaspora, Tayumba directs I've Known Rivers, the museum's oral history and story project. He is also founder and executive director of Forward Ever Media Center, a nonprofit media literacy and journalism training organization for youth of color. And Richard Thompson Ford, a professor at Stanford's Law School and an expert on civil rights and anti-discrimination law. His work has focused on the social and legal conflicts surrounding claims of discrimination, on the causes and effects of racial segregation, and on the use of territorial boundaries as instruments of social regulation. His latest book is The Race Card, How Bluffing About Bias Makes Race Relations Worse. Please welcome our panel. Okay, we're going to start our discussion. Right, first question. There are those who assert that Barack Obama's meteoric rise to the highest echelon of electoral politics is evidence that racism, although it exists, is just not that big of a deal in 2008. Are they right? I'm going to start with Richard.
No, I don't think they're right. I do think that Barack Obama's success suggests that race relations have gotten better, and I think quite a bit better since even the 1980s, and that racial injustices, particularly for the class of African Americans who are relatively well off, the group of people who've been able to take advantage of the changes that the civil rights movement wrought, that for those people, things are much better. Racial prejudice is on the wane, and that's been demonstrated by most reliable sociological accounts, and I think it's dropped off pretty dramatically. But at the same time, that's the good news. But there's a good news, bad news story. And the bad news is that for many African Americans, things haven't gotten much better at all. Racial segregation in inner cities is as bad or worse in some instances than in the Jim Crow era. Poverty and joblessness in poor Black communities is as bad or worse than in the Jim Crow era. The incarceration, particularly of young Black men, is much worse than in the Jim Crow era. So there's a good news, bad news story, and I wouldn't want people to think that Obama's success suggests that the conditions, particularly suffered by the underclass, have somehow magically improved, or that they're simply the result of their own failings or shortcomings. That's not the case, but I do think we have a real split in the African American community between those who are who've been able to take advantage of the gains and the improvements that the civil rights movement wrought, and those that haven't.
How do you see it, Cheo?
Well, Carmen, you know, I thought that what I would do is take a different approach and maybe answer a question of my own making, similar to our Alaskan governor. I'm actually joking.
Oh, I was like, let's go. Okay.
I'm actually joking. The way I see it is that, and I really do agree with Richard, I think that there is now kind of a pregnant pause among America, specifically with African Americans in this election. I was reading today that in the South there's already historic numbers of voters registered, and I think the turnout among black voters is going to be historic. I think that still there may be some disappointment for African Americans and just people of color once if Obama takes the White House, because things will not change overnight in this country. But I do have a lot of hope, because I think he is a phenomenon, and I think he's a very unique person that represents a new form of even blackness in America because of his own background. I can talk about this more later, but there's this merging of people of African descent and so-called traditional African Americans, where people are starting to see the similarities instead of the differences, and I think that's actually fortunate.
Well, let's expand that a little bit more. How do you think Barack Obama has changed the issue of the identity of blackness in America, or has he, Chael?
I think that he has, and I think that there's a lot of positive things that he's done. I mean, I think that we've seen for the first time this dialogue around the whole articulate, clean, you know, what it is to be an African American. And I think really this schism is more generational than it is race. And so I think you see some people who are civil rights and before that generation are kind of following the same stereotypical notions of what it is to be black. But I think among post-civil rights folks, hip-hop generation folks, there's this different attitude about Barack Obama, and they see him, I think, as one of them.
That's interesting. What do you think, Richard?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. I just saw recently a T-shirt and bumper sticker that says Barack is the new black. And that kind of sums up a lot of the attitude that there's a new image that now might be the paradigmatic image for African Americans, and that's Barack Obama, as opposed to the gangbanger, as opposed to the fiery and angry civil rights radical, as opposed to many of the images that are now much or that have historically been much more common, that now Barack Obama, the cool, calm, authoritative figure, is the new image. And so I think that says a lot. I do also agree, though, that there is some unease among some African Americans about the Obama phenomenon, about whether his success will displace their own style of politics, and also, and that's the unfortunate part, but also the legitimate concern that it might give rise to the false impression that we're finished with racism. You know, we elected this black man, and now, of course, we don't have to think about race anymore.
Well, let's hit that nail on the head. In August, MapBuy wrote a much-discussed article for the New York Times entitled, "Post-Race, Is Barack Obama the End of Black Politics?" Could you talk a little more, Richard, about your take on that question?
Yes. I think it may well be that Barack Obama is at least the beginning of the end of a certain type of black politics. And it's not just Barack Obama, but you can look at a whole string of young African-American politicians who I think very much see themselves as a cohort. People like Cory Booker, Deval Patrick, Harold Ford. This group is practicing a new style of politics. They haven't abandoned the black community, and they haven't abandoned the focus on racial issues, but they have made a point of reaching beyond that, of not relying on that base alone as the basis of their politics. They have, I think it's fair to say, rejected what we might describe as the politics of anger and the politics of rage that very much have been a part of black politics in the past, and instead they've adopted, again, this in some sense more conciliatory attitude, but also just calmer and cooler and more authoritative attitude that suggests people who are in some sense more comfortable with the position of power that they're occupying, that they're, they if not take it for granted, at least they feel that they belong there. And that's a different style of politics, and I think it may well signal a change. One, a change in the way white voters and non-black voters relate to African-American candidates, that people like Obama and Cory Booker have shown that they can get a significant white support and therefore win in electoral context in which the other black politicians might not have been able to in the past, but also might serve to to shift people away from some of the older style of politics.
Chair, would you like to weigh in?
Sure. I think that Barack is not post-racial, and I think that that may be a term that the media has adopted or come up for him. I think that if one were to just look at his background and think about the kind of candidate he is, he's a very unique candidate, being biracial, having a father from Kenya, everything, having lived in Indonesia, Hawaii. I think that because he has those attributes, that's probably why he's maybe has been seen as somebody who is post-racial. I think that if he were a Jesse Jackson or some other type of politician who's come out of the typical civil rights era, he wouldn't be seen that way. But I also think that I do think that Barack Obama would be, if he were to fall into that post-racial category, he would fall into that category the same way that someone like Jesse Jackson Jr. would compared to his father. And I think that that, again, goes back to the generational shift and dynamics that I'm talking about. I mean, when we know that when Jesse Jackson came out and, had the
loose... You lobbed me one. That's exactly what okay. We were going to transition
so we can,
to.
So we
well,
can go to that,
let
so.
Me just state the question as I thought about it, and I want you to keep
okay.
going. I had thought about it in these terms. In my opinion, nowhere is the clash between civil rights and post-civil rights generations more vividly illustrated than in the dynamic between Jesse Jackson Sr. and his son, Representative Jesse Jackson Jr., who also served as Obama's national co-chair. And what my question is, what do you think about the nature of this tension, and what should we be doing to heal it, if anything? So, Cheo, if you would continue, that would be
sure.
great.
Sure. I think that... It's specifically about Jesse Jackson and Jesse Jackson
well,
Jr.
Well, what they illustrate.
And I think that what it illustrates is an abandonment of race as a crutch, or an abandonment of the victimhood. I mean, I'm not saying that folks from the civil rights generation singularly looked at their plight and through that lens, but I think that the post-civil rights generation, talking about a generation that came after the civil rights generation, came after, the Black Panther movement had been dismantled, and were left to, in many ways, hip-hop generation left to, create their own culture, their own ideas about self-determination. And so I think that it goes beyond race for, the Jesse Jackson Juniors. I've interviewed him actually before, and even though he bears his father's name, he is very clear about his politics being different and I think more progressive in a way.
Since you have spoken with him, could you illuminate that a little bit more?
I think that one thing that I got from talking to him was that he truly embraces being an American, not that Jesse Jackson doesn't, but it's in a way, I think, that says that I'm entitled the same way anyone else is entitled, and that I have so many great attributes. It's almost that notion of, I forget, there's a poem by Langston Hughes, I too am America.
Yes.
So that notion of, I'm brilliant, I'm so brilliant that how can you deny me from being a part of this? Not that I came through so much hardship and so much turmoil. It's just a different lens. It's a slightly different lens.
Right. Richard, and how would you agree that there is this generational divide, and what are your observations about it, and is there anything that we need to be doing to bridge it?
Yes, I would agree that there's a generational divide to some extent. I mean, I think there are other types of divides as well that characterize this, but I think a lot of it is generational. And
what are those other types as well? What do you think?
Oh, I think there's a class divide. I mean, again, I think there's a huge divide in terms of the black middle class and upper class, the people who've been able to take advantage of the civil rights movement and the underclass, those that haven't. And there's a huge difference in their perspective on the problems that the country faces in terms of race, and a huge difference in their in culture and in outlook and a whole range of things. So I think that's in the mix as well. But I agree that there's also this generational divide among people who care about racial justice issues. And Jesse Jackson and Jesse Jackson Jr., that's emblematic of that divide. I think a big part of it, and I write about this in my book, there's the older generation is probably more likely to think or at least to act in political struggles as if when there's a racial justice problem, there's probably a racist. And we need to find the racist and pin him or her to the dartboard. And the appropriate response is to call the person out on the carpet and stage a protest or something along those lines. And that makes perfect sense. It was appropriate at a particular time in American history to make that presumption because most of the time it was true. In today's environment, I think it's less likely to be true that there are many racial justice issues. And I think maybe most of the most profound ones, where there's not a bigot to blame here and now. Instead, they're the legacy of racism in the past. They're the result of socioeconomic divisions. They're the result of other bad policies.
Richard,
and
could you give one specific example of
sure.
what you're thinking about?
Yeah, neighborhood segregation strikes me as the single most severe unaddressed legacy of America's long racist past. It's the area where civil rights law has almost utterly failed. Successful in public accommodations, everyone knows they can walk into a restaurant or a bar now and they probably don't have to worry about race discrimination. Somewhat successful, although less so in the area of employment. Still lots of discrimination in employment, but the law has had a profound effect. But in housing, not so much. And indeed, housing segregation for the poor is in many instances as severe or more severe than during the Jim Crow era. The isolation of the black poor is more severe. That's not just due to the prevalence of racists. And in fact, it's implausible that they're more racist or that racism is more severe now than it was in the 1950s or 60s. But there are explanations that have to do with changes in the economy, the exodus of the middle class from inner cities, including the black middle class, the shift from a manufacturing economy to a kind of post-industrial economy in which a lot of good jobs for people without higher education have evaporated and colleges become more and more important. You know, I could go on. But that kind of concern, that is a racial justice issue. And I think people of the Obama generation understand that perfectly well. But it may not be the case that the right response to it is a demonstration. It may be that you don't know exactly who you would be demonstrating against. And so there needs to be another solution, and the solution is a policy solution, and it's more of a technocratic solution. And that's where I think this new generation of politicians is headed. At least that's where I'm hopeful that they're headed, to address the problem in that way. But that does require one to build much broader coalitions. It requires long-term and proactive and solutions. And those are not the types of solutions that either civil rights law or demonstrations can secure.
Cheo, you had some thoughts.
Yeah, I wanted to speak to that. I think that Richard brings up some really relevant points in terms of segregation and this whole institution of racism. I think that if one thing that's really promising about the Obama candidacy is that it will, I think, really dismantle this house, begin to help the continual dismantle of this structure what I call racism. And I can look at it personally and look in terms of segregation and housing. I live in the East Bay. I live in Oakland. I live in West Oakland in an area that is historically was historically African American. You know, after the folks who built the ships during the war, worked in the shipyards, settled in West Oakland, and after the Loma Prieta earthquake happened, part of that was kind of sectioned off, and it's now called the Lower Bottoms in West Oakland. And it's a urban blight. There's several housing developments, and there's drug sales, violence. But again, it's this situation where we have been segregated based on, you know, race and class. And so I mention that because I chose to live there. You know, I'm a college-educated person and so forth who, I mean, it was a choice. And I chose to live there not only because there's redevelopment going on, gentrification is going on, there's no property value to speak of, obviously, but there's a lot of, you know, promise for the community despite the violence and the things that are happening there. But at the same time, being the father of an 11-month-old daughter and seeing a gunfight across the street from my house and seeing drug sales going on and finding that the police are not responding the same way they might respond in a different neighborhood, I had to leave. So I rented the house out. Now I live in Lower Piedmont. So I went from the Lower Bottoms to Lower Piedmont. And it's amazing to me the difference in
what is Lower Piedmont?
Lower Piedmont is above Lakeshore, Up Mandana, like million-dollar homes.
Okay.
I'm not, and I don't own. I'm just renting over there.
Yeah, it's an affluent area.
Right, it's very affluent. And so I walked, you know, and when I walked in my West Oakland neighborhood in the Lower Bottoms, depending on, well, in general, I felt okay. You know, having lived in New York for several years, I could handle myself, at least I, you know, would think so. But at the same time, and this is where I guess I want to focus, turn the attention to, that race is just not so binary, and that's the challenge and the problem in the media that I see. It's just people see it one way or the other, and so I've felt threatened sometimes walking in West Oakland, and then walking in Lower Piedmont, you know, just walking my dog, and I see neighbors who beautiful manicured lawns and, you know, Benzes in the front yard, and they see me walking with a sweatshirt, and they walk in their house. You know, so it's those kinds of really, I think, differences that we're stuck on. We're stuck on stupid, I think, in a lot of ways, where we just, as humans, we're trained to see differences. Unfortunately, we are not trained to, like, dig deeper and go beyond that.
Well, again, you've tossed right to my next idea.
Okay.
What does a black candidate owe to black people in particular? And has that changed with Barack Obama? And how? Chair, we'll start with you.
Wow. That's a tough one. I think that a black candidate essentially does have a constituency, and we've seen who is showing up for Barack at the polls. I do feel that he will owe that constituency, you know, something. He would need to look at education, housing, employment. He would have to look at these areas where African Americans have been left behind, and he would have to, I think I would hope that he would address those in a meaningful way. Will he issue an apology for slavery? It'll be interesting. You know, Clinton came short of it. This is so interesting because, you know, who knows if his ancestors, you know, his mother was Anglo. This is a melting pot. There's so many people mixed up. He may have ancestors that were enslaved or that enslaved others.
Right.
So, but will he issue an apology? I don't know. I mean, I think that, like I said, what he would owe is to serve the base that helped support him and get him elected.
How about you, Richard? Do you think black politicians in particular owe anything to black people?
Well, I guess it depends on the politician and how they've campaigned, but I would say that a black politician owes to the black community what any politician owes to Americans, which is to govern on their behalf, to govern in a way that will make real the ideals of this country, which haven't been made real in the past. And quite honestly, I think that any candidate owes that, owes more to the black community that's been left behind, that's in impoverished ghettos, and to the poor in general than most candidates have delivered. So I wouldn't say that's an obligation that's unique to black candidates. I think it's true of all candidates, even though they usually don't fulfill it. I'm hopeful that Obama may be more likely to meet that obligation because of his background. He was a community organizer in the South Side of Chicago. He knows about these problems, and he's aware of them, and I think has ideas about how they might be addressed. But, you know, I think I'd say that all the candidates really have that obligation, and one of the sad facts of American politics is that so few have made good on it.
Speaking of politicians, oh, did you have something to add, Chao?
No.
Okay. Speaking of politicians, how should black people, particularly those aspiring to elected office, best capitalize on the groundswell of support that Barack Obama has garnered across most demographic and all racial lines in America? Richard?
Interesting question. I think, how should we best capitalize it?
I can...
Oh, great. Why don't you jump in?
I speak to a good friend of mine is a guy named Kevin Powell who lives in Brooklyn who was just involved with a campaign for Congress in Brooklyn and ran against a guy named Ed Towns, who basically is a career politician who had been in his seat 30-something years, and the guy's 74 years old. And I think that in that case, Kevin definitely invoked some of the change rhetoric and some of the change messages that Obama has used. And again, I keep coming back to this generational thing. And for me, it's not an either or when it comes to race. I don't see myself as just a black journalist or black consultant or black writer or necessarily somebody who is a writer who happens to be black. I mean, it's a complex thing, and I can't negate it one way or the other. And I think that's just the difference than some of the other politicians.
How about Richard?
Well,
observations.
Thanks for jumping in. I think they could capitalize by kind of riding the wave of this new politics. I think there's a lot of hope in this cohort that I've described of black politicians. It's not just Obama. He's the most visible, the most prominent. But that the take Obama's speech about race after the Jeremiah Wright incident. It struck me as emblematic of the hope that I have for the post-Obama America, the attempt to reach past the distrust and the anger and the resentment that's characterized American race relations on all sides for so long, the attempt to get beyond the culture wars of the 1960s and move to a place where we can have a conversation about race that acknowledges the remaining problems and acknowledges the depth of distrust on both sides, but also looks at it as a human problem and to some extent also as a policy problem and a problem that smart politics can help to fix. I think that's the promise, and that to the extent people can capitalize on that, to capitalize on some of the goodwill that we've seen in the context of the Obama campaign and capitalize on some of the willingness to not so much look past race, but to see the possibility of trust and dialogue across racial lines, that, you know, that's the way we could capitalize on what's happened with Obama.
One thing I wanted to add is that in the media, and again, this gets back to this notion of this binary concept of race. I mean, we can look at, we can look at the negative campaigning of the McCain ad. And see, the thing about racism is that it tends to cover up our marginalize or rationalize the positive attributes of one person, like an Obama, like it's a just some kind of phenomenon, and focus on the negative aspects of another person. So, I mean, an example it would be the fact that we don't hear much about McCain crashing planes, or or meeting his wife in a bar, or there's several things about right. McCain, or Sarah Palin. So what if Barack Obama had paraded, five kids on the stage during the convention? What would people think about the Obamas? But it's that kind of, I think, that double-sided sword that happens all the time. And those are the things that get lifted up in the media. Those are the things that get perpetuated and fed into. And so I think I'm optimistic because of the internet. I mean, because people are starting to not just trust network news and think for themselves.
We have a couple minutes. I just wanted to double back, Cheo, to Kevin. What was he seeing in crowds? What was he seeing as far as being a black man running for office against a firmly entrenched incumbent in the time of Barack Obama? What was he seeing?
I think he saw two things. He definitely had this hip-hop candidate thing that mm-hmm. that people tagged him with, and he saw a lot of young people. He galvanized a lot of youth to come out, but not enough. And I think what he ran up against, I mean, I remember he called me and told me that that Towns had Maxine Waters and President Clinton. I mean, he had a machine.
Wow.
So he had a lot more money. He outspent Kevin, I don't know, maybe 4 to 5 to 1. And so he had this, again, going back to the civil rights movement, Towns had this black church. And he had so much of that is still very powerful. And that's what he had behind him. And I don't know if there's a poll among, African Americans 30 and younger, how many of them are in the church, have been raised in the church. But it's different. And so I think that was one of the things he saw.
It's really interesting. So my another question. John, we talked a little bit about constituencies here. John McCain unabashedly has reached out directly to Joe the Plumber, while with equal and opposite energy, Barack Obama has stayed far away from reaching out to Johnetta, the urban, single mother of three, working two minimum wage jobs, raising her kids without support of their fathers. What do you make of that, and is that the blueprint for how a black candidate has to win in America?
To some extent, I think so. I think the Obama campaign has been acutely aware of what a tightrope he's walking. There was a moment after Pennsylvania when things were starting to look more difficult for Obama, and I remember an interview where he said, you know, I've just now realized just how hard this thing is I'm trying to do. And I think one of the reasons it's hard is because it's important that for his success that he not be perceived by the average voter as the typical black candidate or as a candidate who is going to take sides in some set of racial conflicts or a candidate that's going to, you know, do special pleading on behalf of African Americans. That's a real risk for him. And there is an imbalance there. There's no doubt about it that there's an imbalance there in the way that McCain can reach out to the white working class, but for Obama, it's too risky to reach out to African Americans. I think that's true. And one of the things that you've seen in this campaign is the way that race is. It's just too tempting for politicians not to try to use in the context of a campaign like this. And you know, I think we saw the Clinton campaign use it, and I think we're seeing the McCain campaign use it as well. Playing the race card is extremely tempting, but it's got to be done more subtly now, and that's a progress. You know, we don't have Willie Horton type ads. The Southern strategy of Lee Atwater is now not as effective as it was in the 80s and in the 90s, but the temptation is still there. And so Obama is always at risk of being, you know, tagged with that, made to seem more like Jesse Jackson when he was running for president, a candidate that's a marginal candidate that, you know, won't be the president of the whole country.
I think that, again, it's we're at a higher level now in terms of race relations and class. And as we evolve in this country, it's more like, you know, we were maybe in high school or college. Now it's this PhD level where something like Joe the Plumber, country first, some places or some states are more patriotic than other states. Those, to me, are code words. Those
Real
are
America.
Messages. Right. Those are messages that definitely still come back to race. Race is embedded in that. And I think it's, you know, it's the American skin game. It's race is just something that we're obsessed with in this country. And I think that by facing it head on in a way that Obama has chosen to, at least so far in the way he's run, he's kind of merged into it. I mean, and I think that it just bodes well for this country.
My next question, it again, rolls right off what you were talking about, Chao. Why didn't the Reverend Wright tapes take Obama out? Chao, why don't you start?
Wow. I think that, again, I see, it's interesting you bring those two things up, because I've had discussions with people about the difference between Reverend Wright and Obama. I think Obama attended Reverend Wright's church for some 20 years or so.
Right.
And the church practices liberation theology, which basically looks at the fact that people of African descent have a different experience in this country and would worship in a different way. And I think that, but there are two fundamental differences between Reverend Wright and Obama. Obama, again, is somebody who is biracial. His father's from Kenya. He doesn't, I think, bring a lot of the same kind of racial baggage that Reverend Wright has, a resentment, and maybe baggage is the wrong word.
No,
but
what I wanted to say is, my question is, why didn't America, because I remember the boards right after this, and people were terrified. I saw white voters write, I feel like I was hoodwinked. I'm terrified. See, he does want to get us. Why did the consciousness evolve past that?
Right.
That's my question. Why didn't that association take him out, is what I mean.
And
why
didn't
that make him untouchable?
Right.
And it did not.
Right.
Why
and
not?
And I think it's because, again, for the great, brilliant speech that Obama delivered on race. And I also think that Obama I see Jeremiah Wright as what I would call an unreconstructed black man. He embraces his past. He hasn't necessarily walked the line, and he's not necessarily a cultural conservative, and so he is probably a little more threatening. Obama is somebody who, you know, has gone to Harvard. He's reconstructed this personhood of who he is, but I really think it's that speech. You know, I think the speech did wonders for him.
How about you, Richard? Why do you think that America was able to move past the Reverend Wright experience?
Well, I think the speech was critical. That really, before the speech, the polls were sliding for Obama, and this idea that, you know, we've been tricked, we've been hoodwinked, it was all an act, and in fact he's really this radical black nationalist who wants to, you know, to get us, was starting to really take, you know, to catch fire. And trying to explain to the on a typical television show, why it is that Obama would attend a church where someone's saying AIDS is a plot to kill by the government to kill African Americans, you know, trying to explain why he would have a connection with that church, but and yet not subscribe to those views was difficult in a short format. I remember being on a show where I tried to do it, and, you know, well, we're out of time. Before I could say, you know, I mean, he was in Chicago. He wanted a connection to the black community. Mm-hmm. Trinity Church is the place where the, you know, bourgeois and black bourgeoisie and lower poorer blacks come together, and it made a lot of sense for him to be there. You know, Wright may have made some extreme statements, but, you know, but you don't have time for that. And so the speech was his opportunity to try to bridge the gap between the views of Jeremiah Wright and the view of race that he was trying to express, and to demonstrate why it is that someone would not kick Jeremiah Wright to the curb and yet wouldn't agree with everything that he said. And I think it worked quite well and actually managed to rearticulate the central theme of the Obama campaign, which was that we can bridge gaps, that we don't have to kick out the people that we don't agree with, but we can find a way to bridge gaps, whether they're generational gaps or ideological gaps or the gaps around race, so that it was in that sense quite masterful, I thought, that he was able to bring it back around to what he wanted to talk about. And you know, it was successful. And I think the other thing I'd add is we have come a long way in terms of racial attitudes. I don't think in the 1980s a black candidate would have had a shot anyway under any circumstances, but certainly this would have been it. And people, one thing that it demonstrates is that a lot of white voters in places that you wouldn't expect them to be liberal, where our stereotypes about them is that they're not very open-minded, in fact, were willing to look beyond their fears. And that's encouraging.
Can I add something?
Yes, please, Chad.
I think that, again, if we look at this through the lens of kind of history and know that this is a very important time in history and look at the things that, you know, there's certain ways Obama has orchestrated his campaign, I guess being very shrewd and not necessarily putting out everything about his, you know, racial identity and just basically walking this line. I think that if we were to say, what would a black candidate look like in 2028 or, you know, in 40 years from now, there would be obvious things that candidate would not have to necessarily do, hopefully around race. Hopefully that wouldn't even be a big discussion. And I just think that's one of the things that's marking his candidacy. We have to see that just in this historical framework.
Would Michael Steele or Colin Powell or Condi Rice have to have walked the same walk that Barack Obama did? Richard, I'll take you first.
Oh, interesting question. I mean, yes and no. In a sense, they would have already walked a lot of that walk simply given their politics. I do think that in some ways the road for a black conservative would be easier because a lot of the worries that many voters would have about a black candidate from the civil rights movement with that background wouldn't be there. You already wouldn't, you know, that group of voters.
No community organizer.
Or community organizer, you know, my God. And, you know, in the way the Republicans see community organizer with such scorn and contempt is, you know, we could talk a lot about that. But the idea that, you know, they're going to tax us in order to give welfare to blacks, well, you don't have to worry about that because they're conservative. And they're going to lower our taxes. And so I think that already would make it easier. That having been said, I still think there would be, I still think that race would be an issue in those candidacies as well.
Cheo, how would it be different or the same?
Well, I think it's interesting you bring up those two characters. I just saw W over the weekend, and it was, you know, typical, maybe little less typical Oliver Stone film in that it wasn't so over the top. But there was it was interesting because Condoleezza Rice, I think, Colin Powell were there. I mean, they were involved with this whole Iraq war thing, and Colin Powell came off as being the conscience kind of the nation, of the people who were making this decision. He was against it, but he kind of fell in line. And I think that for whatever, I guess, reasons that we talk about conservancy, black folks being conservative or liberal, I think that for people like them to be at the table, they still represent a group of, you know, they represent black America. And I think that the choices that they would have to make wouldn't necessarily be as black and white. I don't know if you follow.
I understand
what I'm
exactly.
Saying.
That's basically on the trajectory of what we've been saying. I just remember that Condi Rice was very vocal about Barack Obama and her pride in seeing Barack Obama gain the nomination, which I wrote a lot about on my blog. Let's see, I had another question for you. Well, one thing, let me tell you, I sure hope we've generated some questions in your mind, and there's a microphone right there, so if you wanted to start heading over. Anyone? Then we'll keep going. I had a question for you. It's funny, John Stewart made a comment about Barack Obama's family at the Democratic National Convention when Michelle Obama stood up and he said, why isn't he trotted out all of the time? Why don't you think that Barack Obama made more of his white heritage during this campaign? Because he certainly was open about it, but he really didn't play to that. He really didn't amplify that in the way one could argue cynically, perhaps, that he could have. This veteran, you know.
You're saying why he didn't make more of his the white set?
Yeah.
Barack is a shrewd politician, and I think he understands if there's maybe, you know, this is a historic campaign, and if his daughters and his wife, if this, you know, when's the last time we've seen a black nucleus of a family, you know, on stage in this kind of, you know, in this kind of public light? So I think that it's a political decision. I can't really think about, you know, why.
Right.
I'm not sure, but.
Richard, anything to add?
It
just crossed my mind.
Right. It's an interesting question, and I'm not sure. One possibility is that, along the lines of a political strategy, it's possible that he didn't want to seem too exotic. And there's a sense in which in the United States still the mixed race couple is an exotic and taboo thing. It's not, okay still in some parts of the country. And therefore, the offspring of a mixed race couple would also appear to many people to be exotic and kind of hard to understand. Well, where exactly does he fall? And that's a complication that would make people think more about race, which is not what Obama wanted in this campaign. He wanted people to think as little about race as possible. So that's just a guess. But there may have been, who knows, more personal reasons.
I have one final question before we get to your questions. And there are a lot of people angry about this election. That's just true. There are a lot of people angry. How do we heal that as Americans? Do we have, reconciliation talks? What do we do to heal the anger that one person's candidate didn't win?
I think we fix the economy first.
Okay.
I think that there's, when you have somebody like Alan Greenspan apologize, say he made a mistake for the way he kind of guided,
it's a big deal.
You know, the philosophy of deregulation, and now he sees some of the errors in his thinking. We have these bailouts going on. I mean, I think it's focusing on our connections more so than what disconnects us. And I think that I always see that happen. Whenever there are situations that oppress us as a country, we tend to come together, except for maybe Katrina, you know. And it's interesting because Katrina, for me, feels like, the bailout now feels like kind of, you know, white America's Katrina in a way for me. Because, you know, they had, and I say white America, our privileged America, people who have more money historically than people of color, were ravaged by a lot of this, but they got a bailout. And, I'm just kind of saying that when we can come together around issues that affect all of us, like almighty dollar, we can find maybe some similarities and ways to, as Obama says, spread the wealth around. And,
well, to your point just about Katrina, the people did come together. We all wrote our little checks, whatever we could spare. Mm-hmm. We did. The national government is another question.
Right.
But
that's
it's interesting that you're saying that it's exactly what you're saying. We people gave what we could. I know people who picked up and went down there.
Yeah, I volunteered.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. So, Richard, what do we do? How do we heal the anger and move forward?
Wow, and there are a lot of different sources for the anger as well. So I mean, there's the anger of women who think that Hillary Clinton got a raw deal. There's the anger around race. Both there's the anger of people in the old guard civil rights establishment who are unhappy about some things that Barack Obama has done. You know, I want to cut his nuts off, that kind of thing.
Oh, that.
And then of course there's also the anger of the people at the Sarah Palin rallies who they're riling up. Now, one thing that we could do to cut down the anger is quit race baiting. So, you know, that's I think that there's often a undercurrent of racial distrust in much of the United States that can either be calmed down or it can be churned up. And the irresponsible politician stirs the pot for short-term political advantage. And that's a politician that I think it's important not to trust, because if they're willing to do that kind of damage to the social fabric just in order to get elected, then you've got to wonder what kind of job they're going to do.
You mean McCain? Is that what you're saying?
Well, the McCain-Palin campaign in particular has been... has been doing a lot of that recently in their desperation, as their poll numbers have sank.
It has increased.
And, you know, my own sense is that McCain is a decent and honorable man who's been caught up in a very nasty set of circumstances, and it's quite sad, actually, in my view, to see this. But I think that's one. And the other, I mean, I agree that fixing the economy or doing something about people's economic anxieties, people are much more likely to be magnanimous when their stomachs are full. And where things are right now, there's a lot of worry that we've gotten into a mess in being involved in two wars that seem intractable and are draining the public treasury, and now the subprime mortgage mess, and that anger is kind of being displaced in some cases. I have hope that the right government could do good things to fix it, just as we did after the last Great Depression.
Great. Now we're going to go to questions. Thank you, guys. Questions, please. Introduce yourself.
I'm Jessica. I think I'm loud enough in here, so I'm talking about. I think this ties in actually exactly with what Richard was just saying.
Since they're recording it, I think
this
you need to speak to
the mic.
This
ties in with what Richard was just saying. As we get closer to Election Day, I think racism has gotten more overt in the Republican campaign. McCain, yes, and especially I think in Palin's rallies, some of what's being said is really offensive. So I know that Obama has made a point of he's been trying to keep race out of it somewhat, you know, as you've all acknowledged. Is there a point at which he has a responsibility to his supporters to address it or to comment or to say anything? Or would that just be lowering the dialogue to a level that they're trying to bring it to?
Richard, do you want to start? Okay, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, I mean, I...
Richard.
I think that so far the Obama campaign has got it about right, that to call attention to it and try to call them on this, these tactics, for them to do it will only distract attention from the real issues, and it will get involved in a tit-for-tat that's so characteristic of race politics in the United States. I mean, in fact, it wouldn't surprise me if part of the tactic was to try to bait Obama into some reaction so they can say, aha, you're playing the race card, which I expect they would be quick to do. So, you know, I think Obama's winning and McCain is desperate. And, you know, under those circumstances, you don't get baited into a fight.
And again, I would just only thing I would add is that Obama, again being I think very calculating, has a website where he's it's focused on addressing the smear campaigns of the other side, and in fact I think they've already talked about this new brochure or pamphlet that's been distributed that is associating him with AIRS as a, and basically in some ways saying he's a terrorist or he's associating with terrorists, and you know there's no I haven't heard anything from the McCain campaign. And I think that's actually irresponsible because if you have Americans thinking that he's a Muslim or a terrorist and the other person's not saying anything, he could be in harm's way, Obama.
I just wanted to make a quick reminder to our audience that this is the Commonwealth Club's Inforum program, and tonight we're talking about the politics of Black in America today, and I'm here with Cheo Tayemba, Executive Director of Forward Ever Media and author of The Ghetto Solution, and Richard Thompson Ford, professor at Stanford Law School and author of The Race Card. Now let's go to the audience for some more questions.
Hi, I'm Kathy, and first of all, I'd like to thank you for having this discussion. I think it's much needed. I was not particularly a supporter of Barack Obama back in the early spring, mostly because I just didn't know very much about him, and I was on the fence about Hillary Clinton. And I will say that I was not able to see him give what I call the race speech after the Reverend Wright issue. So I printed it out, and I sat down at dinner, and I read it, and it brought tears to my eyes. And I thought, this is the transitional figure that has the courage to say, to have the conversation that needs to be had in this country. And from that moment on, I've been a huge supporter, and I have a lot of hope for what could come to be in this country under his presidency. I know that now the McCain campaign is threatening. We're going to bring that Reverend Wright thing up again, you know, like in the last week before the election. And I would just be curious to understand all of your perspectives on what you think might happen if he loses.
If Obama loses... In terms of what might happen with this country, with McCain being...
And with this forward momentum for Black politicians, with anger in the country, the issue that was just discussed, is kind of... What are your gut reactions?
I think Black people will see it, and they'll be disappointed, and they'll just get up the next day and keep on moving. You know, I think that there's just a history of struggle and a history of pride in accomplishments during the struggle. And I think people will really relish and savor the greatness of his campaign and how this has created a sea change for Black America, for America in general.
Richard?
I agree with that, although I do also think that there'll be a lot of anger and a lot of soul searching and a lot of, what happened? There'll really be a sense that, of dashed hope. And of we had the belief that maybe the country wasn't as racist as we thought, but now we know actually it is just as racist as we feared. I think you'll hear a lot of that. And you'll probably also, though, and this is a worry, you'll probably also hear, Obama and his supporters were naive. And their approach to these, politics was wrong, particularly among some people who have already been kind of detractors or at least lukewarm toward Obama. They'd see that as vindication of their view that this whole thing was a pipe dream from the beginning. So, I would have those kind of concerns.
If we have a stolen election like we had in 2000, if that's what you're saying, then I think, yes, there's going to be palpable anger as well. So.
Yeah. That's a whole nother story. Yeah. Hi.
Good evening. I'm Kelly, and good questions, Dixon. A couple of questions. One, I think it was Ford who spoke to the idea of a Black middle class, And I think that that needs to be unpacked a little bit, because I'd like to know, what do you mean? Are you talking about education, income, wealth, values, associations that black people have? So when we talk about the black middle class, I think it's sort of imperative that we talk about what we're taught, be much more specific. The other question is, Dixon posed a question about, do black politicians owe black people anything?
Right.
And I'd like you to speak to that from a personal perspective, because I am under the impression that when black people are in a position where their voice can be heard by a broad audience, that it's imperative that we move into meetings behind closed doors and speak for those people who don't have a voice in board meetings. And I just think that that's a historical ancestral, you know, it's our ancestry obligation. That's a personal opinion. So I'd like you to speak to that a little bit more. And then, thirdly, comment slash question. I mean, you know, this is only three questions. I could have written 50. I was wondering if, what do you think about the idea of, I think Cheo spoke to the idea of Obama's speech sort of picking him up after rights, you know, the how rights comments were publicized. And I was thinking to take it to another level of possibly that this being affirmative action. So, okay, so choose one of the three. Is this going to be the African-American affirmative action deed? And once he's gone, because he's going to be elected in 2 weeks, once he's gone, because... Will we not be able to speak to affirmative action anymore?
Richard, why don't you start?
Sure. I don't think that, quite honestly, I don't think the idea of affirmative action has any meaning in a political campaign. You know, people vote based on who they think the best candidate is, and it's impossible to have an affirmative action plan. So when people suggest that Obama somehow got affirmative action, I think that's just ridiculous. But to take the other idea, the worry that once he's elected, people will feel we're done with race, and we, you know, and I do think that there's a segment of Obama support that has that hope, that thinks, okay, we're going to vote for this black guy, and then we get to be done. We get to be done with race, and if anyone brings it up again, I can say, look, we voted for Barack Obama. And I think that's a worry, and I think it's a legitimate worry, and I hope there aren't too many such people, but I do think that's one of the reasons that some people in the old guard civil rights establishment are worried about Obama. They think that, you know, uh-oh, this is, the idea is everyone thinks they're going to get a free pass on race.
So could you speak real quickly to the middle class that you were thinking
yes.
of? I think that's an important idea.
That is
actually.
a good question there. And I mean, I do use the term relatively loosely. What I really mean are those African-Americans who have been successful enough and who have been able to take advantage of the changes of the civil rights movement so that they have jobs in the mainstream economy. They have regular employment, they have stable housing, and they have generally stable families. I mean, that's what I'm talking about, as opposed to people who, again, the group of people I'm thinking about, William Julius Wilson has written several great books about the black underclass, but people who live in neighborhoods where they don't know anyone, or very few people who have jobs in the mainstream economy, but everyone's doing catch-as-catch-can in the gray market. People, and as a result, have a whole set of social norms and cultural values that are distinct. They're not black cultural norms, but they're the norms of the underclass, and that make it hard for them to move out of those environments and into the mainstream economy. So that's the split that I'm talking about, and it's true that I use the term kind of loosely to evoke that divide.
One thing I wanted to address real quick,
yes,
and
this
kind of gets to what you've said about if a black candidate or a black president owes anything to, you know, black folks in this country. I think a Barack Obama would owe something to black people, and I think that it would, as I said, be in the form of, an agenda that focuses on all of the areas that we have, you know, historically been lacking. But I would say, here's one example I would say is that when he gave his speech at the Democratic National Convention, his acceptance speech, I felt like he didn't go far enough. I felt like this was a very pure example of how shrewd and careful a person he is. He never mentioned Dr. King by name. That's when I say didn't go far enough. I mean, you know, he arrived to this spot on the shoulders of our ancestors, of the civil rights movement. And I know that if he had maybe invoked somebody like Fannie Lou Hamer and Stokely Carmichael and started, you know, listing names, that would be a problem. But, you know, Dr. King was kind of, you know, reduced to a dreamer. And I really felt like he could have gone, you know, farther. I understand why he did it. But my hope is that once he gets in office, that it won't be that same kind of chess game. It'll be a little different.
Next question, please.
My name is Al Williams, and I come from the other side of that generational divide that you all have spoken
no
to.
No disrespect.
None whatsoever.
But I do hear in some of the comments that you've made, I think Mr. Ford just referred a couple times to the old guard civil rights establishment and mentions made to the unreconstructed black man and that type of thing. I just suggest that maybe some of the perspective that's brought from the other side is born of wisdom and experience and may be able to inform some of the new approaches that are there to politics. So it's not an either-or situation, but it's how do those things come together and work together rather than being as a part of a continuum rather than this is a new thing and that's passé. I wanted to raise a specific question, a comment, very quick comment also about owing something. Former Mayor Joe Alioto of San Francisco said, was famous for saying, you know, in politics you reward your friends and you punish your enemies. Clearly, when Barack Obama becomes elected president of the United States, that would be in large part because African Americans supported him in huge numbers and helped to put him there. So he definitely owes something to the African American community. Race aside, simply because African Americans will have participated in that process and will have supported him and put him there. Just so he'll owe something to labor unions, whoever he owes whatever to, the black community has, he owes a debt there as well and needs to respond to that. The question I have is this. In 1858, there's a mass exodus of blacks from San Francisco to Victoria, British Columbia. They left San Francisco because California was in the process of passing a Black Exclusion Act along with the Chinese Exclusion Act. When you go back and read the newspapers from that time, there was a big argument going on, and blacks had to move away from the notion of describing themselves as abolitionists, because if they described themselves as abolitionists, white supporters would have moved away from them and would not have supported them. You all have talked very eloquently about how Barack Obama's had to position himself today, moving away from issues of speaking to very directly to black issues so as not to present himself as a threat, as that negative image. So if that is the case today, and that was the case in 1858, how much progress have we really made in terms of the acceptability of a black candidate who can really speak very clearly and forcefully to issues affecting the African-American community?
Richard, why don't you start with that?
Sure. And by the way, I do want to say, I mean, I agree with what you, and I appreciate your comments about the generational divide, and I don't want to suggest that, you know, this is the old guard we should leave behind and forget about it.
No.
But I do think that there's a generational divide that has at least occasionally expressed itself in, you know, kind of surprising terms. I mean, again, the Jesse Jackson comments, with a level of resentment that kind of surprised me. And, you know, but I do think that you're right to suggest that the worry, and it's a legitimate worry, about the new race politics is that people vote for the black candidate and then they think we have a free pass on race, we don't have to talk about it anymore, and that it actually makes it harder to address the concerns of the black community because the candidate can't do it. He's trying to get elected and needs to court white support, and the people who vote for him think that they're all done. So that's a legitimate worry. My own view and hope is that that's not what's going to come to pass, but I understand it, and I think it's a fair thing to be worried about. In terms of how far have we come, given the need to continue to do this this dance that we've described. Well, I do think that we've come a long way. I think the fact that we're that a black candidate has received the level of support across racial divides that he has is speaks to real changes in what we could call old school color prejudice. That I really think 15, 20 years ago, plain, simple color prejudice would have been it for any black candidate. And that isn't true today, and that's progress. But what you're suggesting is that we still have a long way to go, and I think that's true, too. There is, among a lot of people, anxiety and distrust, and that, you know, that leads to the need for this type of this type of dance around race issues. And in some ways, it may mean that it's as hard for someone like Barack Obama to raise the race issue as it is for, you know, past presidents.
Chael, do you want to weigh in?
No.
Okay. Now, we're really running tight on time. We have about 4 minutes, so questions only, please. Come on up.
All right. Well, my name is Pascal. I'll try to do this as quick as possible. So jumping directly from a look back at where racial politics has been, I'm going to ask you and talk a bit about potential future issues and hope your crystal ball is a little less foggy than mine. So we've talked a lot about the sort of bipolarity of race issues, politics, and a lot of other things in American society. And I've noticed both from living in South America, where there's a lot of, you know, gentrification going on early stages, and also coworkers of mine being labeled Oreos and various other hurtful
things. I've only got a couple, literally 2 minutes.
Exactly.
You're going to cut me off.
I'm trying to get to the point, ma'am. Do you think that there's any potential for, in future, the disadvantaged African-American community and then the sort of new African-American community as exemplified by Barack Obama becoming split between the political parties, or someone trying to drive a political wedge between them?
I don't think there's much chance that they'll be split between the existing two political parties. I find it implausible that, at least given what the Republican Party has been doing in this campaign, that they're going to gain a lot of black support anytime soon. I do think it's possible, though, that you'll have a split between in the black community politically generally that might lead to either some third party picking up a lot of support, or even if not that, very different priorities and different political styles, and, you know, a split between this kind of new approach, the Cory Booker, Harold Ford approach, and an approach that we associate more with more typically with black urban politics.
Okay, we have time for one last question, I think.
Hi, my name is Anya, and my question is basically on the notion that Barack represents this new identity of a black male, not necessarily the gangbanger who sells drugs. Do you feel like those black people who do live in urban environments will now be more motivated to become more educated and to really embrace that new identity, or do you feel like they'll sit back even more and be like, well, a black man is in the White House, he's going to take care of all of our problems, I don't really have to do much?
It's a very good question. I think that I can reference a film, a documentary that a friend of mine did. It's called Barack and Curtis, and it looks at Barack Obama and Curtis, 50 Cent, which is a rapper, and it looks at basically the ideas of black masculinity that Barack Obama exhibits and that this gangster rapper exhibit, and draws parallels, but mostly a lot of, you know, differences between them. And I think that when you look at disaffected black youth who basically, you know, I work with African American youth and Latino youth in Oakland, and I can pretty much read kids when I encounter them. And a lot of these kids come out of the California Youth Authority. And there's some that I call will knows, and there's others that I call won't knows. And the won't knows are just not there yet. You have to reach them where they're at. So those that may have some notions about Barack Obama being president, meaning that they can just kick back or whatever, I think there's an evolution that has to happen, and they have to be reached where they are to have them understand that at the end of the day, they have to still take responsibility for the, you know, for who they are and be a part of the community. So,
Richard, want to weigh in on that?
Sure. I remember an article that said something like, "Is Barack Obama the end of hip hop style," or something like that. You know, they said a kid with baggy jeans and then Obama, with the suggestion that, you know, now everyone's going to go out and buy a suit and try to look like Barack Obama. I don't think that's realistic as a hope. But I do think that we shouldn't underestimate either the symbolic power of for a black kid of having a black president and seeing that person representing the nation in its highest office on a day-to-day basis. I think that that's going to have an effect, that it's going to improve self-esteem, that it's going to improve people's horizons and sense of possibilities. And I do think it'll have an effect, although we shouldn't, exaggerate it.
Okay. Well, let's give a big hand to the panelists for their thoughts here tonight. And now this meeting of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.